Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Monday, June 14th. I'm Joyce Napier. Evan Solomon is off today. Coming up on the show, terror charges laid against Nathaniel Veltman, the man accused of intentionally driving into a Muslim family in London, Ontario, killing four members and injuring a child. We've got legal analysis standing by. And military golf course meetup.
Not only, Mr. Speaker, does this show zero respect for Operation Honor and zero respect for victims, it shows there's zero respect for this defense minister among the top brass.
The acting chief of defense has informed me that the vice chief of defense staff is no longer in his role, effective immediately.
The second in command of the Canadian military is stepping down from his post after going golfing with retired General Jonathan Vance, who remains under investigation for allegations of sexual misconduct. MPs dig into the divisions in the ranks. Plus, a fight to compensate First Nations children back in court.
Every First Nation child that has suffered discrimination at the hands of a broken child welfare system in Canada will be fairly, justly, and equitably compensated.
The Liberals commit to compensation, but are actively fighting a human rights ruling in court today. We'll speak with Cindy Blackstock, who's fighting for children discriminated against by the child welfare system. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's international tour continues after a packed weekend at the G7 summit. In the UK, the Prime Minister made his way to Belgium to attend the 2021 NATO summit. While the COVID-19 pandemic topped the agenda at the G7, Russia and China were at the forefront of the NATO meeting. CTV senior political correspondent Clegg McGregor reports from Brussels.
After years of division caused by the previous president, Joe Biden promises a united response to global security threats. And a harder line against NATO's chief adversary.
I'm not looking for conflict with Russia, but that we will respond if Russia continues its harmful activities. And we will not fail to defend the transatlantic alliance or stand up for democratic values.
That's a message Biden will take directly to Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday when they meet in Geneva. Their first face-to-face since the U.S. election comes as NATO deals with increasing Russian aggression from its military and from cyber attacks.
Our relationship with Russia is at its lowest point since the Cold War. And Moscow's aggressive actions are a threat to our security.
Canada has a role in NATO's response to Russia, with troops deployed to Ukraine and Latvia, a deterrent to Russian forces massed on their borders.
Russia as a very present and real threat, which is why we have the enhanced forward presence that Canada's part of, why Canada has troops in Ukraine, for example.
There is also growing concern around the leaders' table as China builds up its military strength with the world's second largest defense budget.
China is increasing its expansion, its influence around the world, and is increasingly running up against NATO, whether it be in Africa and the Mediterranean, or more specifically in the Arctic as they're trying to engage more.
In the summit's closing statement, NATO stopped short of calling China a security threat, instead saying its assertive behavior is a systemic challenge to international order.
Defense spending by NATO countries has been increasing, but with their economies all hammered by COVID, the alliance has no plans for any new major missions. For Canada, that means no requests to deploy more Canadian troops abroad. Glenn McGregor, CTV News, Brussels.
And thank you, Glenn. So the second in command at the Canadian Armed Forces is stepping aside effectively immediately. Former Vice Chief of the Defense Staff, Lieutenant General Michael Rouleau, made the announcement following public outcry from a controversial round of golf. Lieutenant General Rouleau and Vice Admiral Craig Baines are in the hot seat for the game with retired Chief of the Defense Staff, General Jonathan Vance. General Vance is under investigation for alleged sexual misconduct. He denies any wrongdoing. The military police runs that investigation. Remember, the military police reports to the Vice Chief of the Defense. Here's what Lieutenant Rouleau had to say about the impact of the game of golf. I am acutely aware of the tumultuous times we are navigating together. Like all of you, I have been working hard to deliver on our commitments and to inform our way forward. I am a huge advocate for change. Indeed, many of you have heard me speak about leadership culture and accountability for years. I have fully embraced the need for us to foster greater diversity, inclusion, and respect at all levels to curate our culture and to uphold accountability across our institution. Now, can the federal government take control of this leadership crisis? And how can the women and men of the military trust their allegations will be met with fairness? Let's bring in the MPs. Anita Vandenbeld is the Defense Parliamentary Secretary. James Bizan is the Conservative Party's defense critic. And Randall Garrison is the NDP's defense critic. Good afternoon to the three of you. Very nice to see you. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Anita Vandenbeld, I want to start with you. Why should the men and women of the military now trust that senior officials will treat their allegations fairly or even impartially?
Yes, thank you very much for the question. And we understand very much that what needs to be done right now is a regaining of confidence and trust. And what we saw today was the acting chief of defense staff acted quickly and swiftly and decisively. And General Rouleau, as of immediately, is no longer in his position. So what I would say to survivors and to men and women in the Canadian Armed Forces is that you've seen now that there are consequences, that there is a strong commitment from the Prime Minister, to the Minister, to the senior leaders of the Canadian Armed Forces and DND, to make sure that there are consequences, that people are held accountable, and that we restore that very important trust that members need to have. The very fact that anyone thought that this was appropriate to do this, to have this golf game, actually indicates the level of the culture change that is necessary. And it's that culture change that the Minister and our government have been acting on and continue to act on for the number of years, and Madame Arbour and Justice Fish's recommendations will go a long way to that.
Thank you. Okay, James Bizan, I want to hear you about this. I'm thinking of the Prime Minister. So he's at the NATO summit. It's a military alliance while his military is going through this kind of turmoil. You know, that there would be an appearance of conflict of interest at this golf game, in many people's opinion, is a no-brainer. So what is your take? What went on there? Why didn't they realize that this could look really bad?
Well, it was definitely a failure in leadership on just making this decision. It's a failure of judgment. It, again, you know, calls into question their commitment to victims of military sexual trauma. It calls into question, you know, whether or not Rouleau, who is the commanding officer that oversees the Canadian Forces National Investigative Service, was interfering in the case that's been investigated against, or the allegations against General Vance. So, you know, it all comes down to that the old boys club is alive and well, that the culture continues to be broken because of this lack of leadership that we've seen from Minister Sajjan. And so you have a minister here who failed to act upon the Justice Deschamps report from 6 years ago, a minister who covered up the allegations against General Vance for the past 3 years, and a minister who hasn't enacted the Victim Bill of Rights for 2 years. And so you've got no one that respects Minister Sajjan. They don't respect Prime Minister Trudeau in this, since his office was complicit in this cover-up, as we found out through all the testimony we've heard at committee. And, you know, it just comes down to that there needs to be action taken. And they could have been on this, you know, at least three years ago, and we wouldn't be in the crisis that we're in right now that undermines the morale of the Canadian Armed Forces members. It undermines the trust that Canadians have in the institution. And, you know, we said, you know, months ago as Conservatives under Aaron O'Toole, that we need to actually start looking at the whole aspect of freezing promotions, freezing salaries, investigating independently everything that has happened.
Now, Randall Garrison, I want to bring you in here because I'm wondering what this sort of very sad game of musical chairs at the, you know, by top-ranking generals here in Canada do to the rank and file of the military, to morale, to recruitment, to obviously to the women who are complaining or who have filed complaints of sexual harassment or misbehavior. What does this do to a country's military when this keeps happening again and again?
Well, you know, Joyce, you talked about the outcry across the country about this golf game. And whose voice did I not hear? I did not hear the Prime Minister. I did not hear the Minister of Defense. So once again, this government sits back and waits for somebody else to take the action. I was very outraged, and I don't think it's just a private matter or it's just optics. This tells you there's still something seriously wrong at the top. And when it says, you know, that General Rouleau has resigned, no, he hasn't. He's been shuffled, as you say. And if we continue this shuffling people around, there'll be no confidence at all. So in the Defense Committee, we've been trying to get at who's responsible for this lack of action over the last 6 years. Because we can make great recommendations about the future, but they sound exactly like the recommendations that were made 6 years ago. And so what we have is somebody to step up and say, enough is enough, no more, and I will take action every time I see this pop up. Instead, we had a minister who waited for the Canadian military to arrange a shuffle of people out of the jobs to try and cover up what was a clear conflict of interest.
I want to move to the NATO summit, because that's also, you know, something happened there that was quite important. The leaders came out with some strong words, you know, about their obviously fraught relationship with Russia and China, but even calling China a systemic challenge. So, you know, this stand that Canada took, Anita van den Meld, at the G7 and at NATO angered the Chinese more than ever, telling the world to butt out of our business, even calling the Prime Minister here, the embassy here, a hypocrite, because, you know, Canada's human rights record after the discovery in Kamloops. How does this help free the two Canadians that are in jail, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor?
Thank you for that. Before I go to that, though, I'd like to correct something that Mr. Garrison said about the fact that General Rouleau is being shuffled. He's not being shuffled. He is transitioning out of the military entirely. So I just wanted to correct that.
To be fair, Anita van den Meld, he was already on his way towards that transition.
He was going to take a different position. Actually, he was on his way to take a special advisory position. He is now transitioning out of the military entirely. We will have an interim vice chief until General Francis Allen, who is extremely... We will have a very, very strong vice chief in General Francis
Allen. Anita van den Belt, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let's transition to the two Michaels. That's an important conversation. Yeah. What happened at the G7 and NATO doesn't seem to have helped Canada in, you know, sort of getting the allies to help out with this. What else can Canada do, and what can these allies do to help free these two men that have been in jail for over 900 days?
Well, I think, first of all, we have always said that multilateral work is absolutely essential. It is exactly how we're going to get the kind of change that we need. Our commitment to NATO is and remains and will continue to be very strong. The work that we're doing at the G7, you also saw at the G7, a commitment on prisoners of conscience. And so these are all things that you can see that Canada is working very, very well with our multilateral partners, because that is exactly the way in which we are going to be able to defend democracy, to be able to ensure that we live in a secure world
okay,
and that
I'd
we
like
can
to
maintain our
yes.
freedoms and also that of our, yes. our citizens.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to, James Bizan, I don't have a lot of time left. This doesn't help the case of the two Michaels.
Well, you know, every step of the way, decisions made by the Trudeau government hasn't helped Michael Spavor or Michael Kovrig. And appeasing isn't the answer, and they don't have strong enough diplomatic relations anymore. When you look at the communist regime in Beijing and their continued intimidation of foreign nationals here in Canada, their ongoing crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. You know, Justin Trudeau can even recognize the genocide against the Uyghurs as a genocide. And then you also have the ongoing saber rattling and threats coming from Beijing against the government of Taiwan. So, you know, there needs to be stronger actions taken, but we can't get Justin Trudeau even make a decision on banning Huawei from our 5G. So how can he ever make a serious decision when it comes down to the diplomacy and the I guess, the way forward to get the two Michaels out of prison?
That's unfortunately all the time we have, and I'm sure this conversation will come up again. Anita Vandenbelt, James Bazin, Randall Garrison, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the 20-year-old man accused of killing four members of a Muslim London, Ontario family and injuring a child is now facing terrorism charges. Nathaniel Veltman is already facing four counts of first-degree murder and one count of attempted murder. These new charges against Veltman come days after the family was laid to rest on Saturday. Let's dig into what this could mean for the case with Solomon Friedman, a criminal lawyer and partner at Friedman Mansour LLP. Hi, Solomon Friedman. Thanks for being there. What does this addition of terrorism tell you about this case?
Sure. So what it signifies is that investigators have likely found evidence of motivation, because the real difference between the first-degree murder charge and the addition of terrorism charges is evidence of motive. And, you know, given the passage of time, it's likely we could talk about some of the ways that investigators may come to that conclusion, have found evidence of motivation, which is sufficient to satisfy the test in the criminal code for a terrorism charge.
So what kind of motivation typically would they have found?
Sure. So what the criminal code requires in order to support a terrorism charge in a case like this is essentially three things. The first one is intent to cause death or bodily harm. And of course, that's made out likely. If there's a murder charge, you need intent to kill for murder. But there are two other things. There are two other parts of that motivation formula. So the first one is that the act itself has to have been committed for some political or religious or ideological cause or objective. But the second one goes even one step further than that, and it says on top of that ideological purpose, it has to also have had the motivation behind it, the purpose of intimidating the public at large or one segment of the population. And we can see, obviously, on the face of this case why that may be apparent, but there may be a great amount of evidence that's unknown to us that further supports the motive elements of the terrorism charge.
I mean, I don't have a lot of time left, but I'm curious. So why now lay these terrorism charges and not, for instance, 4 years ago after the Quebec City mosque massacre, where it was evident from the beginning?
Yeah. What I would expect here is that an investigation began immediately, obviously following this horrible, horrible tragedy. And, you know, they go through an individual's communication devices, their social media accounts. They find out who they've been talking to, what they've been writing. And presumably they've, you know, come upon something that really supports this in a tangible way. At the same time, there's also a practical issue here, which is a terrorism charge actually makes the case harder to prove for the prosecution, right? Mm-hmm. You have not just the crime itself, we have to prove the additional motivation clause. And in terms of punishment, it does nothing. Murder, first-degree murder, is punishable by the highest sentence known in our criminal code, life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for 25 years. This doesn't make the sentence any higher. So, you know, it's a decision that prosecutors have to make with scarce resources as to whether or not they're going to attempt to lay that terrorism charge. Now, we can see many good reasons. You know, it highlights from a public interest perspective, you know, the danger faced by Muslims as a result of their faith and the fact that they are under attack. So you can see certainly why it would be something prosecutors would be interested in doing, but it's really a case-by-case determination that depends on the evidence and the public interest that supports that evidence.
Solomon Friedman, always interesting to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
And coming up, Ontario will lift restrictions at the provincial border with Quebec on June 16th. But is the country ready to lift restrictions at the Canada-US border too? Or will the U.S. go it alone and unilaterally open their side of the border? We'll take that question to New York Congressman Brian Higgins next. Stay with Power Play.
We have been having close engagements with the American administration, with border officials, with between ministers and members of the administration back since the very beginning of this pandemic. Obviously, with the longest undefended border in the world between our two countries, it is extremely important to get back to normalcy as quickly as possible. But the work.
And welcome back. Before they moved on to Brussels for the NATO summit, both Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and U.S. President Joe Biden briefly met to discuss the Canada-U.S. border, but no announcement or hints were made about when the border would reopen. The border has been closed to non-essential travel since March 2020. You do the math. But as both countries ramp up their vaccination efforts, some U.S. politicians are calling for the border to be opened back up. So as Providence begin to reopen, should the Canada-U.S. border be next? Let's bring in New York Congressman Brian Higgins, co-chair of the U.S. Northern Border Caucus and the Canada-U.S. Interparliamentary Group. Welcome, Congressman Higgins. Nice to have you on the show. I know you're one of those people who wants that border to reopen. What arguments are you making? And when do you think this should happen?
Well, it should happen immediately. I mean, people that have property in Canada should be able to visit their property. People who have been separated from their loved ones for the past 15 months, people that want to transact business. You know, we've been told by U.S. and Canadian public health officials, follow the science, follow the facts, follow the data. And what the data tells us is if you are fully vaccinated, you have a very powerful immunity from getting COVID or giving COVID. And therefore, whether it's 10% of the Canadian population or 45% of the American population, those who have been fully vaccinated should be able to cross the border incrementally at first, and then look for a more comprehensive reopening of the border on or about July 1st.
Would the states consider doing this unilaterally, Congressman? Is there talk in the U.S. of saying, well, we'll open our side if the Canadians don't do theirs?
Well, look, I think ideally, I think your prime minister, Justin Trudeau, President Joe Biden are people of goodwill. They obviously have a good diplomatic relationship, but they did speak about this issue while they were in Europe. But, you know, you just have to, again, follow the science. And our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the existential public health agency in the United States, says if you're fully vaccinated, you can go back to pre-pandemic activity. You don't need to wear a mask and you don't need to socially distance. I think what's being lost here is the potency, the power of this vaccine, this medicine against the disease. And if you're fully vaccinated, you can't give it, nor can you get it. And therefore, you should be able to travel, again, to a property, to be reunited with a loved one, and to transact business.
But you would need sort of proof of vaccine at the border. But let me play devil's advocate here, Congressman, for a second. So we just saw the UK push back their reopening by another 4 weeks due to the Delta variant. Now, the UK was set to lift more restrictions on June 24th. That's the same day the Canada-US border closure is set to expire, maybe be renewed again. Is it wise to reopen the border when the threat of the Delta variant can derail that progress you're talking about?
Well, I don't think it will derail the progress that's been made. Our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention take into account, first of all, that all viruses mutate in many, many times. And the potency of these vaccines, in many cases, 95% effective, 90% effective, are effective even against the variants, including the Delta. So, you know, again, I think people are missing the really miraculous accomplishments that's been made here, and that is the development of a vaccine very, very quickly in one that has been tested rigorously for both safety and efficacy. And because it is so effective, our Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, our public health officials have deemed this to be provide very powerful immunity from both getting COVID or getting COVID, and so powerful that you no longer have to socially distance. You no longer have to wear a mask. So those people, I mean, think about it. I represent Buffalo, New York and Niagara Falls, New York. A lot of people in my community, I spent my summers as a kid growing up on the Canadian shores of Lake Erie. A lot of people in our communities bought property at Bay Beach, Crystal Beach, Thunder Bay. Two people that are fully vaccinated, driving up to their cottage to enjoy their property, to maintain their property, they pose no risk to anybody else nor themselves. That needs to be recognized. For the 15 months of this pandemic, we have all been told on both sides of the border that the game-changing moment, the inflection point, would be the availability of vaccines. And nobody anticipated that they would be this powerful of immunity, providing immunity against getting or giving COVID.
Congressman Higgins, I know this is your battle, and you've got some pretty powerful allies in Congress. So we'll see on June 21st whether the border restrictions will be extended or whether they will be lifted, as you wish. And many of us who have family in the States do as well. Congressman Higgins, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we head to break, here's some other news you need to know. Ontario will soon be reopening its land borders with Manitoba and Quebec. The government has decided not to extend the closure or non-essential travel past its expiry date this coming Wednesday. It says it made the decision now that Ontario is in stage one of its reopening and after consultations with the chief medical officers of health. The border closure was imposed in April to reduce COVID-19 transmission. BC Premier John Horgan says the province will move to stage two of its reopening plan on Tuesday. He says modeling shows the province is on the right path to proceed with its next phase of its restart.
Step two ends the current travel restrictions in British Columbia. However, we are advising against non-essential travel from out of province. We want that to remain in place as we watch what other provinces across the country do as they start their restart plans as well. Step two means being able to host a birthday party with up to 50 people in your backyard or in a public outdoor space. It means that it will be safe to go to a movie with some friends. Or more importantly, we'll be able to do what we haven't been able to do for the past year, and that is watch our local sports teams in action. And that I'm very much looking forward to.
And under step two, indoor fitness classes can resume with reduced capacity, and outdoor gatherings limit will increase to 50 people. Movie theaters and banquet halls will also be allowed to reopen. And the two people charged in the death of a Saskatchewan RCMP officer made their first court appearance today. 26-year-old Constable Shelby Patton died Saturday after he stopped a stolen truck from Manitoba. While outside his cruiser, the officer was struck by the truck and the suspects fled the scene. They were later arrested and are now facing several charges, including manslaughter. And stay with us. The legal battle over the welfare of First Nations children continues this week. What will it take to put an end to this 14-year fight? Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada, Cindy Blackstock, joins the press gallery next. Stay with us.
When it comes to compensating children, I think it's important to remember that the actual order to pay compensation was only issued a few months ago. And as part of this process, and this is something that I and the Government of Canada are resolutely dedicated to, no child has had to testify and we do not want any child to have to testify in court.
And welcome back. A 14-year-old fight for the well-being and welfare of First Nation children continues to rage on. The federal government is back in court today fighting against two orders from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. What is the government fighting? One orders the government to compensate First Nations children who were unnecessarily taken away from their parents and give them a $40,000 compensation each. The other orders an expansion of Jordan's principle. Jordan's principle ensures First Nation children get government services without jurisdictional fights getting in the way. Our first special guest is at the center of the fight. What will it take to end this for once and for all? Let's bring in the press gallery. Tonda McCharles is a senior reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. Ian Bailey is a reporter with the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau as well. He writes the Globe and Mail's daily political briefing. And Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. Nice to see you all. Happy Monday, although it's very cloudy out there. Cindy, I want to start with you because we've had many conversations, you and I. You've been at this for almost 15 years or past 15 years, fighting Ottawa in court. The government does agree First Nation children deserve compensation. So what is their argument to keep delaying?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think they have a convincing argument. What they're saying now in the hearings today is a couple of things. One is they're challenging the jurisdiction of the tribunal to rule on compensation. And if you look closely at the Canadian Human Rights Act, I don't think there's anything there for them to rely on. They're arguing basically that systemic discrimination does not include individual damages. The other thing that they're talking about is they're really trying to, in some ways, minimize the harms for children. When they did their opening statement today, Joyce, they actually said, well, you know, if you only remove a child for a few days and they go quietly to another house for 3 days, I thought, you know, I've done child protection for close to 40 years. That's not the way I would describe it. And the other thing they're doing is they're trying to say, well, maybe we could do it through a different forum. But the bottom line is they just need to follow the orders and comply with the law and pay the $40,000 minimum. And then they can pay other children more if they need to.
So, but they do want to pay, but they don't want to pay. That's what I don't understand, yeah. Cindy. This has been going on for 15 years. So on the one hand, they say, yes, they deserve compensation. On the other hand, they're fighting every step of the way. So is this going to go on for many more years?
Well, if they continue, their rhetoric doesn't match their legal positions and their actions for children, then yes, it will continue because we absolutely are not going to stop until there's full culturally based equity for kids and justice for kids. Right now, what they're trying to do is make all of these flowery statements. But if you really look at what they're doing, it's almost completely contrary to what they say they want to do. So they were ordered in 2019 to pay this compensation, and they haven't paid these kids a penny yet.
Tonda, you know, does this make political sense to you? You know, from a government who has said that this is their most important relation ever, it kind of contradicts the fact that they're fighting this contradicts. Or do you see a legal or a political reason for the government to delay these compensations?
Well, look, I think that it's not just this government that's been fighting these various legal points, is it? It's previous governments as well. So politically, does it make sense? I mean, we got, you know, unanimously last week, the House of Commons saying, oh, yes, the government should act. But when it comes right down to brass tacks here, they're arguing legal principles and the legalities and the politics of it don't mix, particularly at this time. I mean, I think Cindy is probably pretty acutely aware of the fact that public opinion in this country is shifting very much towards supporting whatever it takes to compensate the children of these kinds of systems, be it the child welfare or health and education. Canadians do want to see fairness and justice there. So, look, the political moment is upon this government to actually address the injustices.
Ian, I want you to continue on Tonda's thought, because in the light of the recent discovery of unmarked graves at the site of the Kamloops residential school, it would seem that this would be, sadly, I may add, a perfect time to settle these two cases, and to compensate these children.
Absolutely. This comes, obviously, at a time when Canadians are thinking about, you know, these issues and the way we treat First Nations, obviously with the discovery of the residential school, and sort of questioning about how we can do better. Obviously, Tonda has made the point that this predates this government, and it's come through here, and it's come through to this point. You know, a government, and this often comes up at this time, but a government possibly looking to go to the polls later this year and to be judged on its handling of First Nations issues might want to consider resolving this sooner than later. But for the reasons I guess Mr. Miller and the Prime Minister have outlined, this carries on. I guess the government did raise other issues today on the file, First Nations file, that is, announcing that Indigenous people can apply to reclaim their traditional names on passports. So it sounds like perhaps they were putting things in the window, but that obviously is an important issue, but obviously not perhaps as important or it doesn't put away the need to deal with this issue.
Cindy, you know, back to you. So Mark Miller says that he wants to give more compensation than those $40,000. That's why they're waiting longer. Why not just give them the compensation and move on?
Yeah, that's it. Like, we talked to Youth in Care, actually, Joyce, about a year and a half ago. And we talked to them about how this compensation would be rolled out in a way and how they would use it. And what they were talking about is they wanted to pay to go to education. They wanted to pay for cultural ceremonies, reconnecting with their families. Well, they've already been waiting a year and a half. There's nothing stopping them from paying it. And then the other part of this case that they're judicially reviewing is they don't want to provide services to First Nations kids off reserve. So they're fighting on both ends of it. The kids that they've already hurt, and they're fighting to continue the harm today and into the future for these kids off reserve.
And this case will go on all week, if I'm not mistaken, Cindy. You'll be in court all week on this particular case. Thanks so much for sharing these thoughts and for coming on the program. We're going to Ian Bailey and Tonda McCharles will stay with us. And we have an update on the investigation into allegations of misconduct against Major General Danny Fortin, who was leading federal vaccine distribution logistics until mid-May. Major General Fortin's legal counsel has said today filed a notice of application for judicial review in the federal court on his behalf. Fortin is challenging the decision for him to not be reassigned. He argues an inadequate level of procedural fairness and alleged improper political interference. CTV continues to follow this story and will bring you the latest details. And coming up, the Liberals are looking to wrap things up before the summer break. Number one on the government's agenda to pass their budget implementation bill. So what's at stake if the government's agenda doesn't reach a breakthrough before the break? We'll ask Nick Nanos from Nanos Research. We will join our press gallery next. Stay tuned. And welcome back. The clock is ticking for the Liberals to pass their budget implementation bill, C-30. With the House expected to rise next week, the Liberals have put forward a time allocation motion to limit debate on their budget. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland said the government was left with, quote, no choice. She blames the Conservative Party for delaying progress on the budget implementation bill. Are the Liberals trying to get their pre-election budget passed so they can start campaigning on their $101 billion in stimulus spending? Let's bring back our press gallery panel to weigh in. Joining us is the Toronto Star's Tonda McCharles, the Globe and Mail's Ian Bailey, and our special guest for this round is Nick Nanos, the CEO of Nanos Research. Welcome back to my two colleagues, and welcome to you, Nick. What do you make of the Liberals putting forward a time allocation motion to cut debate on the budget implementation? They seem to be rushing through like they... Something like wanting maybe to go in an election soon or something like that?
Well, it's pretty clear, Joyce, that they are clearing the deck for a potential election. After all, it is a minority government. And when we look at the things that are in this budget, things like extending the benefits until around September the 25th to help seniors, to help businesses, student relief for students and their interest payments, it's pretty clear that the Liberals want to be ready in case there is an election this fall. And they basically want to gear up in case the opposition parties decide that they want to what I'll say, amp up the political heat and potentially go to the polls.
Do you get the sense, Nick, that Canadians are enthusiastically welcoming a potential election here?
Well, Canadians never enthusiastically welcome an election. I know for us, Joyce, the three of us on the panel, the four of us, we look forward to elections because there are times for Canadians to render decisions about the future of democracy. And polling that we recently did, of note, about 4 out of every 10 Canadians actually said they were okay with an election this fall, which is a significant number compared to what we've seen in the past. So they might not be enthusiastic, but I think there are enough Canadians that are open to having an election that it wouldn't necessarily be a massive downside, assuming, and this is critical, that the pandemic remains under control, that vaccinations continue to roll out, and there's some type of quasi-normalcy in our lives.
So, Tonda, the NDP are not going to let the budget fail. They've said it. They are going to vote with the government. They don't want a confidence vote, a non-confidence. So, since, you know, what's at stake if the budget gets delayed? So what if we come back in September and they continue debating it?
Well, I mean, the budget, it authorizes a whole bunch of spending. I think the budget is a priority for this government. I don't see that not passing before Parliament rises. If anything, I would imagine they'd extend for a few days to make sure it does. But, you know, invoking closure on the debate is going to make some of this happen pretty quickly. But there's no question, like Nick says, that, you know, they are setting a stage, right? All of the debate in all of this is all about going to the polls eventually. And whether it happens, you know, in July, August, September, October, or it happens later in the year once they're very sure everyone's vaccinated and the variants haven't gotten a toehold or, you know, the upper hand, then the Liberal government will have, you know, controlled that narrative, right? I think that the smarter betting is on a later, like in the early fall election. I don't think there's any question that's what they're doing. Look, they're tabling legislation that has clearly no hope of getting through, but it's a marker. It's telegraphing to Canadians, look, see, we're trying to do business, you elected us, and we're trying to push things through a minority parliament, but those guys won't let us. So it's all about building the narrative.
Absolutely. I just need to interrupt this panel for an update to the report we just gave on Major General Danny Fortin challenging his removal. He accuses the government of political interference. Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan has responded to CTV News saying, as this is an ongoing legal matter, it would be inappropriate for us to comment at this time. So I want to go back to you, Ian Bailey, because we're talking about potential or possible elections. I'm wondering, you know, Tonda said that's the narrative. Their narrative, and they started that last week, saying we're trying to do all these good things, the Liberals are saying, and the Conservatives are just stalling and opposing, which is, I think, what the opposition is doing in a Canadian parliament anyway. What does this look like from the outside, from people who are looking at this that are not political reporters like us, wondering what is the matter with these people? Why do they want to go into an election? What do you think Canadians looking at this squabbling in the House of Commons in the middle of a pandemic are thinking? What does it look like?
I imagine, sad to say, that many Canadians aren't watching the details of this unfolding in the House of Commons. For those who are, and I would go with what Tonda said earlier, it's a marker of policy. And when you watch the squabbling and the debate, you know, you see it's like shadow boxing ahead of the big fight. And obviously for the Liberals, they want to get their stuff through the House. And we'll see if they, through legislation enacted. And we'll see how it plays out. But this plays and looks like light markers, as Tonda said, light sort of underlining policy interests. Aaron O'Toole was talking about Bill C-10 today on broadcasting and sort of talking about, saying stuff about the bill, praising aspects of its goals that might be favorable for voters in parts of the country should there be an election. But again, no, I suspect many Canadians are watching this in great detail at this point.
Yeah, that's why we're here. Nick, I want to ask you, what are the polls telling you? Are the Liberals seeing a possible majority? No government wants to be a minority. Are they seeing better numbers in their future?
Absolutely. Actually, what we're seeing is fewer and fewer Canadians are citing coronavirus as their top unprompted national issue of concern. There's now starting to focus on jobs and the economy and the environment. The Liberals are in majority territory. And how about this, Joyce? There might be a vaccination honeymoon. It's kind of like, you know, when you're sick in the hospital, you get out of the hospital and everything's wonderful for the first 2 days before the aches and pains return. I think what the Liberals are probably looking at is that there'll be a short-term honeymoon after the vaccinations roll out before the real economic pain of business closures and job losses kicks in. And that honeymoon will probably last for another 90 days. And then after that, reality will set in. So perhaps the Liberals want to get in before the bad news shows up.
And that's all the time we have. Nick Nanos, Tonda McCharles, Ian Bailey, thank you so much for being there. And that is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for joining us. Evan Solomon will be in the chair tomorrow. Have a safe and wonderful evening.